How do you live your life like tomorrow matters? Perhaps you're already growing food, consuming less, connecting with your community. Perhaps you're already thinking hard, keen to see the world a little slower, greener, healthier. But where to begin? Here on the Future Setting Podcast, we dig deep into the hearts and minds of blissfully normal people doing bloody amazing things, unearthing their moments of contradiction, their hopes and fears for the future, and what galvanises them to action, in the name of inspiring all of us to do a little more in shaping a better future today. I'm Jade, and this is Future Setting. So today I am chatting with Hayley Morris. Hayley is the Executive Director of Morris Group. She's the founder and chair of Sustainable Table, is a board member of Sentient Impact Group and director of Impact Sustainability. I'm feeling exhausted, and if you are too, there's more. She is also a mum of three. To say she sounds superhuman would be fair, but in fact, she still manages daily meditation practice, is forward in exploring taboo spirituality, and is a trusted and values-aligned philanthropist who supports projects in the climate and regen ag spheres, which is actually how I know her. I've been lucky enough to work pretty closely with this powerhouse, and I've long wanted to bring her to this conversation because I'm intrigued by her ability to straddle various spheres simultaneously, which is quite a skill. With a business head, she leads with heart, and she's navigated the complexity of playing in a sphere which can be fiercely conservative and a little bit closed to those taking a heart-led approach. Hayes, welcome to Future Setting.
Oh, that was probably the best bio I've ever had written, especially the bit about the taboo practices.
I know you do them, but I don't know if everyone knows you do them.
Is that the area we don't go to?
No, it's completely up to you today. And actually, I would love you to go there if you're happy to, but you know, keep in mind this isn't just a conversation between us.
Yes, welcome. Thank you.
Yes. So, look, I know your story quite well, but I think there is this fascination with people who don't have the privilege that you have to support projects in the way that you do, in understanding how you got to where you got to. I would love to know your backstory.
It's definitely a privileged position. The first thing I'll start with is I was chatting to another philanthropist, somebody else who was in a privileged position recently, and she said, you know, you go into this and you think, you know, you make your money and then you give it away. Like, surely that's easy. And, in fact, she's found the giving away bit so much harder than the actual making of money. It is interesting because that's the bit that I think feels like it's simple to other people. I think my backstory is very linked to my family. So my father was very successful in his career. He started an organisation called ComputerShare, which for those in the finance and business world often know this company because they're the ones that manage shareholders. So if you've got any holdings, then you'll get a dividend statement or your communications from a company called ComputerShare. So they're very unsexy, very, back-end infrastructure tech sort of business, but very critical and has done extremely well. And as an Australian sort of export, it is now the most dominant player in the world doing that service globally. So we were, I would say, a very sort of middle-class average family for most of my childhood until roughly late teen years, so getting into high school, when the business started doing much more international expansion. And so the profile of the organisation increased significantly. And there was a lot more, I guess, media, as there tends to be, about people who are, you know, making rich lists and et cetera. And so that sort of shifted, I think, for us, who I was, and, you know, going through a very formative period in your teenage years, you know, questioning what that all means. And all of a sudden, people who didn't really care about me cared about me. And it was, I was old enough to recognize that shift that happened, is that, oh, okay, money equals attention. Money equals that people start to want to know you. And all of a sudden, the boys that didn't care cared, which, you know, I guess going through that, I had a really interesting kind of relationship then with money, in that I wanted no association with it whatsoever because I wanted people to know me and to like me, as opposed to, you know, the badge of money. But I think important in that kind of context was we were really established as a family. We were established as people, you know, into my late teens. So I didn't feel like we grew up with a silver spoon in my mouth. Surely we 100% grew up in a very, privileged way compared to majority of people around the world, but it wasn't ridiculously privileged for an Australian standard. I think in Australia, relatively high standard of living. So there was this sort of significant change that happened in my late teens, and then I sort of thought I would move out of that, but I actually ended up working directly in the business, and had this really excellent sort of grounding in a business world, working in Computershare, and I had the opportunity to work overseas, had some great stints in the US and in the UK, and was on that kind of lovely trajectory where everybody's sort of molding you to be, following the footsteps and being in a senior role. All of that kind of came crashing down. I think there was lots of things going on for me kind of energetically at the time that I had no words for. But we had this amazing trip to South Africa with our family, and it was probably the first time we'd been just as a family in, years and years, because at that stage I would have been about 24. And when I was on this trip, I had sort of a come to Jesus moment where, learning about the functioning ecosystems of the outback. We call it outback. It's the game parks, but they're national parks. Learning how the large mammals fitted in with the small tiny ones and the insects, and then the role of their traditional owners and their indigenous people, and how they used the plants for medicine and only harvested what they needed, and I learned all of this sitting on a car looking at it. I'm not part of this system, and this is a beautiful functioning ecosystem, and where do I fit into it? So something like turned on in me, and then came home from that trip and was just, I just couldn't live my normal life. I was everywhere I looked. There was just environmental damage. There was, I was just all of a sudden aware that if I put something in the bin, it goes to landfill. Like, of course it always did, but all of a sudden I realised, well, hold on a minute, what's landfill doing to the world? And I'm turning on the tap. I mean, that's fresh water that I'm just wasting here. And, what all this concrete? Where did all the trees go? Like, it was just this very awareness of how disconnected our society had become. And so basically I left the work, left Computershare, just had to go and answer some questions for myself. And so that's kind of where I started on the meditation, not necessarily taboo path, but got quite into, trying to understand myself, trying to understand the world, trying to find my people too. It was this feeling of being very separate, and nobody else is asking these questions, and I feel quite alone. And so that kind of got me into the environment movement. From the environment movement, I did some overseas sort of study. And one of those study trips I did was on sustainable ag and food security. And so that's kind of where things got me to the world of food systems for Australia. And pre that particular trip, I'd set up a small little NGO called Yalbulla, which was named after for a Fijian guy that I'd met on one of these courses. And it was very much just a sort of trying to bring awareness to environmental issues. But when I came home from that trip, we started researching the food system, and I partnered up with a school friend, Cassie. And we put out a book which was called Sustainable Table. And that book got a huge amount of attention, given in our little community and sort of just from it. But people were suddenly so interested and like, wow, there's this strong link between the environment and food. So we were so kind of caught up in that energy that we ended up deciding to call the organisation Sustainable Table. And that was kind of like where that kind of piece birthed. I can keep going on if you'd like me to go back where I get back into the family business and into philanthropy. Do you want me to keep the journey?
I keep going because we're nearly at the bit that the next question comes in.
So I think that food system is, and it was very early on in that kind of journey, is really stayed there. where I then not necessarily got distracted, but had another itch that needed scratching was around working with businesses on their sustainability. So I had gone back to do some consulting work with Computershare as their sort of like sustainability representative. And so this would have been in about, you know, sort of 2007, 2008. So, you know, relatively early, around the time of like the Inconvenient Truth coming out. So people were starting to come aware of climate change, but very like, what do we do when we don't really understand this? One of the things I noticed as strong across all of the different businesses that I did work with was that they were really just sort of, you know, touching around the edges in terms of what they were doing. And it was, you know, let's put recycled paper in the printer. Let's put a little line on the bottom of our email that says, please don't print this. And let's put some recycling in, and then let's call ourselves a sustainable organization. And to me, it wasn't quite cutting it. And, you know, consistently felt like people weren't actually taking strong action without sort of a really measured approach with measurable, actionable change. So thus developed a technology platform, which still exists. That business is called Impact Sustainability. We work with businesses on measuring their performance and helping them take action and then report. And now that's kind of wrapped in this whole world of carbon accounting and as a baseline to then set your net zero target. So I was doing Sustainable Table, Impact Sustainability quite thoroughly, and I had a bit of another life moment, and that was when my mother passed away. And so that was in 2014. And I took out sort of a few months from everything, just put a pause on life and really sort of sat with, you know, her death. And, you know, you've even probably heard in my story, right, I've talked about my father and my father's success. I haven't necessarily talked about the role my mother played, and I felt like this period of my life was really important for that, to sit with what are the messages that she had that I probably never listened to, because I was off on, you know, let's go, this is the trajectory, I've got so much that needs to be done. And her messages were always, you know, take it slowly, Hayley. You're young, you've got your whole life ahead of you, you don't have to do everything today. And I think that was exactly what I needed to do. I needed to just take a break and really sort of mindfully think about what my next step was. I had also probably had this, you know, I need to prove myself as an individual and not be defined by my father. And so I had resisted being involved within what had become, I guess, our family office, which was an offshoot of, you know, further investments, which had started to happen as my father was himself moving away from Computershare in a management position, and, you know, setting up for different investments. And I had really sort of not wanted to be involved in that, because I wanted people to think of me as like a broke NGO leader, not as a rich philanthropist. And when I was sitting with a kind of post-mum death and the grief there, it was like, Hayley, that's your ego that's getting in the way. It is not about you and what people define you. It is about the change that you're trying to create, and where are you going to create the most change at the moment? And it is probably embracing the world that you're trying to push away. So with that, my next journey came back to Morris Group, and that is our family office and our investments. And so I agreed with my father to take on a leadership role there, which is, like you said at the start, executive director, so I sit across the boards. But what I get to do in that space is I get to really push, I guess, my agenda, in the sense that I'm the one who pushes, you know, how do we operate more sustainably? And when I say sustainably, it's, you know, across environment, social, the places we operate, the people we work with, you know, our employees and the communities, and then the planet. So I get to do all that, and then I also get, which is amazing, the philanthropy. So the foundation, Morris Family Foundation, was set up at a similar time that we were setting up the family office. We basically, the way philanthropy in this sense works, a private ancillary fund, is that you move assets. So at that point, it was basically we move Computershare shares into a new entity, which is the foundation. And then your requirement is that you, the value of those assets, you give away 5% of that every year. And so we just had this sort of, you know, wonderful pot of money that we needed to give away. And that sort of led me on the sort of whole journey around philanthropy. You know, like I started out this big long monologue talking about was that was so much harder than we anticipated. And I thought because I'd done Sustainable Table and I was involved in the not-for-profit space, I would know how to do that well. But it is really a bit of a learned art skill, and that's sort of been a really fun journey, sort of working my way through. And the other side to the philanthropy is the investment side, and that's an area where I'm probably leaning more into at the moment, as I've probably dabbled a little bit more in that in the past. And so that's where we, I guess, we're diversifying those assets. And if we're selling out of ComputerShare, we're going to put that capital into something else. How are we investing that capital? And it should, logically be invested in the same value set we're using when we're giving it away. Because what's the point of putting those assets into, an extractive economic system and then, try to use the philanthropy to like mop up the problems at the other side? And that's sort of my, newer roles around sitting on the board of the Sentient Impact Group. I did have a board role in the Impact Club, so really sort of building up the movement around impact investing. And now I guess even just sort of seeing where the world's come together in Sustainable Table and the work that we're doing now with the RIF, which is, really kind of leaning into the exciting role that investment can play in a really sort of systems-changing way.
You are a dream to interview, because I feel like I might just have to ask you three questions and we'll have our hour summed up.
Here's the backstory.
The backstory on all the bits in between. Just a second ago, there's a whole lot of questions that have come out of that, and I will get to those. But just before we get any further, you just talked about the work that you've been doing most recently with Sustainable Table and the RIF. So the RIF is the regenerative investment for farming and fibre. And I would love to know, you are the driving force behind this. You are young, you are female, you are wearing a million different hats. You also are very good at protecting your sort of private space and your, your spiritual and whole self. So I would love to know how someone in your position, or really what the process was for you to really weigh up where you went with this. I can see that you have a really solid driving force that means you're not going to back down on the things that really sit deep in your gut. You are going to drive them. But there are so many challenges, because you don't tick the box of typically being the person that people will listen to. But I know, having worked with you as my chair in my role at Sustainable Table, that not many people listening to this will actually even know I hold. So I'll give a bit more about that at a later time. I would love to know what you thought and weighed up when you decided to put your absolute all into making this where you put your energy, and the bravery that it was going to take, the courageousness that it was going to take to change a system and lead this, because you are without doubt leading it, and you are doing it on an untracked path. No one knows what this looks like. No one has the answers or a previous experience doing it, not even in other countries. We're discovering that as we're doing this work. So what was it that made you think, yes, I can do this, and I've got head and heart to do this alongside the balanced existence? And what did you imagine it would look like at the end of 5 years of making it happen?
Okay, there's a lot in there. So the first thing I think that comes to me in terms of decision making or where that started, I actually think it probably started quite a number of years ago when I was getting into the world of philanthropy, and I was like the token person who gave into food systems. The sustainable ag was effectively what they summed it up as.
I can't ever imagine you being token, but anyway, keep going. You saw it.
I was the go-to woman. Was like, oh, Hayley, you should speak to her. Hayley does stuff there. And I was like, why do Sustainable Table? So it was an interesting sort of step for me, moving out of Sustainable Table into philanthropy in a day-to-day perspective, because I had to then go, okay, so, you've got a vision of like, I'm in an organization and I think this organization can solve the system. Well, it can't. It can do a part of it. So what are all the other players that we need? I can't just speak to a group of philanthropists about food systems who are interested in giving into food systems and say, you should just give to Sustainable Table, because clearly there's bias there. So what is the whole parts and the pieces that need to need to change and what are they? And I felt very unprepared for to give that answer. And so I guess that really led me on the research path around what are the questions, what are those triggers or the levers that we can start to pull that is going to shift the system. And I think, you know, I didn't even have a language of systems change, I think, at that point in time. It was just this sort of feeling of I can't just, you know, recommend one organisation, so what's everybody else doing and what does that actually look like? And by the way, what is actually changing our system? What is this future system look like, you know? So starting that process, and it was a very icky process, like it was, you know, like we'd try something and we'd bring in someone who would do like a system map, and then you'd end up with this complicated map and you go, yeah, that doesn't feel like it's answered it for me.
I'm just walking
this path now. Yeah. and so we kind of led into doing this kind of play space. And everyone said, oh, you know, I think the play space is the way to go. And I was like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's go down a play space path. Mm-hmm. And we started the Mornington Peninsula Casey Cardinia Right for Change program. But I think that was hugely powerful in terms of getting the sense of play space is so important for food systems. And that sort of, you know, decentralization, mass decentralization is really, you know, underpinning as a big, big driver for where we're going to get to in terms of, you know, that future. So I think, you know, this is kind of the journey we're on. I think then the piece around, you know, investment and, you know, how do we start to push that conversation? That was a... That probably started in a very similar way. Impact Club. So now I'm on the investment hat on and I'm in that world and it's like, oh, Hayley's the person who cares about food systems. Where should we invest? I was like, oh, okay. So we've got maybe one or two investments in food systems. I can't just recommend two. We've got to really think about like the broad spectrum of it. So it was like, who's done this? What's looked at it? We looked at a couple. There was a US examples of where they'd start to map the food system and then was like, okay, great. We need a map for Australia. That's what we need. Like, let's actually look at who's doing what and then overlay that view that we now started to understand around systems change of what are the levers that need to change, what is the role for investment in particular so we don't get stuck in a world of philanthropy. And that was kind of the start of the riff idea. So when it was it a big decision around, you know, do I lead in it or do I – probably lots of little decisions, I think, that kind of led us there. So it never felt like it was this big, you know, hairy, you know, goal to like, you know, lean into. Because I often within these like, you know, sort of icky research change, systems change, like if you actually knew what the journey was, you'd probably think quite a bit about whether you actually do it. So thankfully, little bit by little bit. But I also think like in your question there's a piece that was coming up for me around, you know, decision making and, you know, like it's very intuitive for me and it's very energy based in terms of, I think you can really just, you can have a conversation or a meeting or a discussion. And like, if you're feeling into where that's going, the energy is either not there or it is there. And, you know, like sometimes you're just having a bad day, right? So you can't read too much into a bad meeting. But if you, when there's flow behind you and you can feel that energy pushing you, like we're onto something here. This is, you know, working in the right direction. I don't feel like I'm sort of trying to push things uphill. People are really receptive. I think a really common one for me is that when you start just, you know, I'll just drop it into things, you know, if I've asked to speak in philanthropy or Impact Club or whatever, I'll drop ideas in just in what I'm saying. And when they start to then come back to you and people are like, oh, hey, you know, when you said that thing about intuition, or you know, when you said that thing about, I've been thinking that too. And then someone else is like, I've been thinking it too. And then you're like, okay, there's something here. People aren't really addressing it. We just need to bring it more to the light, have conversations about it and kind of go with that. And then all of a sudden, before you know it, it's a thing.
So you're sort of juggling this. That's what I said at the head of all of this, that I'm intrigued by your ability to straddle various spheres simultaneously and that you do have to operate in what is traditionally a hard-nosed business environment with a business head, and you definitely have a business head, but you do in fact lead with heart and intuition. And so I'm intrigued by that because this sphere often also demands things like impact outcomes And, you know as well as I do that we've been grappling with this for the last 12 months, trying to work out what the impact outcomes actually look like. And I heard a beautiful sentence this morning, which was lack of relationship wants a number. And so how beautiful is that?
I love it.
Yeah. She said it, I was like, that's my answer to everybody's question. But the reality is that, our world is a complex and a multidimensional one, and we, in fact, need to be complex and multidimensional too. And as soon as we become singular in our dimensions, then we stop being integrated with the world that we are trying to represent and that we're fighting so hard for. And so maybe in the world of impact investment or even philanthropy, outcomes actually need to look like beauty and complexity and, you know, multiplier effect and things that are in relationship and things that we know intuitively. And you just spoke beautifully to the fact that you know it intuitively. It's just that you don't hear people say that very often in the business world, because that sort of isn't tangible, and it's not what the industrial system has led us to believe is an outcome that we can measure and that we can back. And so it's incredible to hear someone that is in a position of enablement for others say, I'm led by intuition, and if it feels right and if the energy goes there, then I'll go there too. Are you happy to talk about the most recent debt-based farm scenario that you have got going on?
Yeah, absolutely. And that one has definitely been driven by intuition and also relationships. And I'm wondering whether the person who is involved in that relationship was the one who said that, because that sounds like a beautiful tenure.
She didn't, but we both went, she was in the same meeting and we both went, my heart is beating fast.
It started with the beautiful Tanya Massey, who also works with us at Sustainable Table and the lead author on The Riff, getting in touch with me to kind of bandy around some ideas and to just get a sense check on an investment that she was pulling together outside of Sustainable Table within her family farm. She sent me a sort of a proposal, but it was just beautiful. Like, it was very much written by her family, co-written by her family to, you know, the species list, you know, that are on their farm. It was the appendix. And so different to a pitch deck, which is what I'm used to people sending over. And I was reflecting when I was talking to Tanya at the start and said, you know, it's such a nice framing to start a relationship with a beautiful, heartfelt, honest, transparent document that says, hey, we don't have all the answers. We want to kind of create something with you. Then when someone pitches to you with a fancy looking, I have all the answers document, my instant reaction is find the holes, find what's wrong. They can't be perfect. It's not. So there's like this different energy that you kind of get from that, as opposed to, hey, I want to work with these people. They're being honest, they're saying that they want assistance themselves. Maybe there's something that I can bring to the table. So that sort of started us on a little bit of a journey around how do we support the family, and how does investment support the family to buy a part of the family land, which was sold off many years, I think about 14 years ago. And so bring those kind of two pieces of the farm back together. And I was kind of excited in the sense of, well, hey, here is an opportunity for us to do a working example of all of that you're researching and that you're telling. If we need an economic system, an economic product, which is fundamentally based on, you know, values of trust and transparency and relationships, like, let's do that and see what it looks like and see whether we can bring other people along for that journey. So I suddenly then became a fund manager, which was putting another hat on, and went out there and tried to get some investors on board and raise some money. So I did okay at that. I got a couple. One of them was my auntie, so that was an easy audience.
No hanging fruit.
Fruit, exactly. But it was good, because we had a lovely man called Andy Davey, who from Just World Investments, and my auntie and our family office, and so we came together and we helped buy the land back. So went to the auction and secured that land. We did all of this with no legal agreements in place, not one signature written down on anything to say there was a huge amount of trust on the Massey side that we were going to actually come through and give them the money to actually fund the land. But all of us were just saying we want to make this happen and we want to see it replicated. You know, there'll be plenty of other farms out there in a similar situation. So as we've kind of developed that, we've gone a little bit clearer on exactly what it will look like. So it'll be a debt instrument, but it'll be, we call that compassionate debt. So there'll be safeguards, I guess, and I'm conscious of using safeguards after the government's banding around this safeguard mechanism. At the moment, it's not that. it's a nice safeguard that supports the people it should support. So basically just we didn't want something that meant there's a capital repayment or any sort of repayment coming when there was climatic and environmental challenges in place that would mean that the farm wouldn't be able to operate at a certain level that would be able to pay down debt. So we sort of said, okay, well, this debt's kind of based on business performance. So we worked out what the performance of the business could be. We worked out what the working capital needs of the business could be to get it to the level that it needed to start making repayments, pull that all into a total figure, and then decided on what that minimum number was. If the profit drops below a certain amount, there will be no repayment back to investors at that point in time. If it goes over a certain amount, then we'll have a percentage of that which goes to investors, of which a percentage is capital repayment and then a percentage is what we call upside dividend. And so the upside dividend is basically when the business is doing well, we're all doing well. So capital is repaid and we're getting extra. We're figuring and we're, and this is, you know, estimating based because it's a new emerging space, but the carbon markets, the biodiversity markets, all of that's in development is really that opportunity for us to be playing in that upside piece. So we've been quite conservative with the modelling of it. So we're looking at kind of a base case scenario of repayment and how many years and what sort of term that looks like. And then ideally, you know, when you've got farmers like the Masseys that we're very comfortable and confident in, that we've got the potential to be building on sort of add-on opportunities around those different nature-based markets. It all comes down to relationship. Yeah. In saying that, though, I think we don't. There's a piece around how do we, like, model that or put it in a little. I'm using my hands, which you can't see.
We need a canister. We need a little tube that we can set up.
We need a little canister and work out how we actually turn that into some sort of financial product, which still. Allows there to be less relationship between the parties. Because if we want this to be replicated, and I'm using the word replication over scale very intentionally, purposefully, we want it to be replicated, then we need to make sure that there is effectively, we use the structures that we have around us, sort of legal structures and financial and what we know in this space to allow it to be replicated when you don't have such a beautiful relationship that already exists between the parties, because that's going to be critical. However, the investors that are likely to want to do this and to kind of come on board and as we look to replicate, there more than likely needs to be a sharing of values. Otherwise, there's probably another product out there that's going to suit you better.
And there also needs to be an understanding that the power dynamic that plays out traditionally in traditional sort of investment spheres is being given permission to step aside and look at this in a whole different way. You don't actually have to follow the same rules that have always been in place. You can actually recut this and recreate this in a way that works for both the farmer who's in the ground doing the work and the investor who is still trying to get their head around the complexities of what farming regeneratively or an outcome of farming regeneratively looks like. So it's quite an incredible example of not only looking at this systemically, so that you're not only fixing the food system, but you're leading by example and slowly fixing or changing the investment system that can underpin and support that evolving food system at the same time. And it just is an excellent example of the fact that we don't live in silos, we live in these deep complex webs that are multidimensional, and we are all interactive. And even though for the last 200 years what we've looked for is, you know, figures as our outcomes of success, success can actually be felt, and it can be led by intuition, and it can be cognizant or leaning into the fact that we are human beings over and above everything else, and we are living in harmony with the ecosystem around us.
Yeah, very well said. Thank you, Jade.
Hayes, how much is enough in your world? What keeps your life rich? What makes your life matter? Where the nuances and the magic pops of delight that make every day worth being here?
So interestingly, I was pondering this recently. I feel as though for a good chunk of time, that focus for me was so wholeheartedly on, like, we've got to solve all of these big environmental problems. So it was quite, you know, the world will thank me when I'm dead, you know, sort of, that I've put everything into making a difference. And as of last year, I think I was coming up a lot up against myself as like my own worst enemy in terms of, you know, the tide has changed dramatically, you know, definitely off the back of a new government, but just people are starting to come aware. And all of a sudden, all the stuff that you feel like you've been talking about for years is now, everybody wants a piece of it and everybody's interested. And all of a sudden, Hayley Morris has got something that people want to hear. And I'm like, that's really exciting. And so therefore you're answering everything, you're doing absolutely everything. And then you're like, I've got absolutely nothing left for the people that matter to me. So I'm getting somewhere with it. The people that mattered to me was a bit of a coming home for me sort of late last year. And that's my family. It's my husband. It's my three children. And I'd even probably put in there into that circle as well, like my close friends and my sister. So that rich relationships and time with them is paramount. Being a present mum, being able to go to the odd sporting occasion, the odd one, I don't want to do all of them.
No, it's the end of your concerts, you don't want to do all of them forever.
And so I think that's really important there for me. The other really, the bit of coming home for me is going down to the farm. So we've got this beautiful property in Cape Shank, which we've had for 20-odd years as a family. That's kind of where I felt like I really got to understand what regenerative agriculture means, because we had a place to practice it and do it and get involved. And so that the farm sort of sits kind of under my remit in terms of within the family. I take sort of management control of it. And when I'm there, I'm absolutely home, and it's my centering place. Mm-hmm. And I feel I don't think I've quite got it the way Indigenous people talk about their connection to country, but that's the one place I'm like, I think I can understand it when I'm here, because that's how I feel.
And you're gentler, you know, when you're down there too.
I'm much gentler. So my world has really sort of been about trying to actually bring that gentleness that I get at the farm and bring that into, you know, this more corporate world. And, you know, that's when I'm able to use things like, you know, lead with your intuition and, you know, bring that actually into my business meetings and see how it lands.
Mm. Yeah, and it's really important to hear that it doesn't really matter who you are and how you're living your life, that need to be really human and around those people that are your blood, your everything, is critical as individuals.
It's 100%. Like, I think the viewing wealth and privilege from the outside is very romantic, and given it means that there is opportunities to, you know, have you know, see wonderful parts of the world and have wonderful experiences. And none of that came into my answer, you know, like the thing, and that's the same for everyone. It is that connection to nature. It is being outside and it is with the people that I love. And that is, you don't need money for that.
You've talked about your love of the farm. And well, I talked at the very beginning about the fact that you meditate daily and that you've explored a whole heap of other sort of alternative spiritual approaches. What do you do on a daily basis to decompress? I mean, your work life, your workload is stacked like no one I've ever met, yet you never don't have time for the people that need to talk to you. So you never say no, yet I know you have really clear boundaries. How are you managing that on a day-to-day basis?
So you've made it sound like I'm managing it better than I feel personally that I am managing it.
Well, that's a bloody good illusion that you're creating, because never have you not responded to a text or a message or an email within minutes that I've sent you. And I'm one of many bombarding you.
So my daily practice sort of starts, you know, quite early because I want to get up before the kids. It's that probably one time of the day. So it involves a breathing pranayama practice and then followed by just a general meditation, more Vedic style. So it's pretty much just allowing my brain to go, you do not have to do anything right now. You know, the three kind of things that I'm telling myself is, you know, I am nothing, I do nothing, and I want nothing. In this space and time, go away. And, you know, like often I'll find myself at that point in time wanting to plan my day. Plan your day. And then later, Hayley. So there's a lot of getting to know myself in that time and seeing the different parts of me kind of come up. And the part that wants to plan things, the one that you said is always very efficient at getting back to you. Like she's very prominent. One of the traps I think you can fall into when you've got a strong part of you is to want to push it away. Go away, stop, try this, stop, like, you know, and it's that whatever you resist persists. So it's about sitting and noticing it and making friends with it and understanding and thanking it for all of the wonderful things that it does for me to make me get through the day and efficient and be able to have time for the people that I want to have time for. But it also, I think, sitting there in that sort of space then gives me that, you know, it's the practice, right? It's the practice of staying mindful and staying present, that doing it at the start of the day very purposefully to hopefully take that into the rest of the day. So in some ways I think that is a bit of a maintenance practice. I think the pieces of stepping to the next level is can be varied and different sort of journeys. And, you know, sometimes that's like, say, going on a retreat or, sort of immersing myself in a different sort of spiritual leader. I went through a big Eckhart Tolle phase. He's like the power of now, man, like for a while. And then there was a big Joe Dispenza phase and he's sort of like quite woo-woo and out there. And there's the art of living, which is the practice that I do every day. And then sometimes I get kind of heavy into that and the Sudarshan Kriya practices. And but I kind of keep it light and journey and add the curiosity to it. Which, I mean, it's hard to sort of say what it does, but I think it obviously is really powerful because it's not like a silver bullet solution, right? Like it's years and years and years of practicing and doing it that then you notice, like one of the things that I've been told a lot is like you're really resilient, Hayley. And I think resilience is great, but it can also completely undermine you because I define myself by being a resilient person and then I don't actually allow myself to feel stuff because like, no, resilient people just keep moving. But in saying that, I think there is maybe like a hardiness that definitely has been built up in there because I've allowed myself to sit with all of those uncomfortable feelings because it's the only way to actually show up to other people and be, recognize when they've got uncomfortable feelings because they're being, you know, reactive or yelling at me or they're doing this and just seeing what that bit in me is like, oh, I know that. I know when I've had that feeling. I want to yell too. And I think that's kind of, yeah, I think that's probably my why I can do that. I also think maybe there's a genetic thing in there. Like my father's a bit the same.
I feel like you're sort of equal part dad head, equal part mum heart, you know, and you've really, really given yourself a whole lot of time to let your identity form around both of those different skills or attributes. And maybe, you know, you've really kept the ego in check and questioned and challenged that in just the right proportions to ensure that you can be high functioning but balanced and sort of generous to others and self all at once. The work that we're doing and all of the hats that you wear are so intense and earnest and sometimes debilitatingly concerning that it can be really hard to maintain a level of joy. What is it in your day that's giving you not just joy on a day-to-day basis but ultimately hope?
Do you know, I feel like a big sigh. The answer to this changes and shifts, I think. So if I think, I'm just going to think through, like, you know, a couple of days and tell you what I think makes me laugh. I think definitely like young kids, like they are hard work, but man, they're funny. You know, like my youngest is 4 and then my son just turned 7 yesterday and then the eldest is 12, so she's less funny these days, but the younger two are still making me laugh. Just the cute stuff that comes out of their mouth. And I think I get a huge amount of joy, out of actually like these sort of conversations. And I really have found myself in my work now able and surrounding, you know, there's the part that isn't, but then there's a part and a growing part where, you know, you come together to have a conversation around impact measurement and you end up talking philosophically around what is wrong with the system while we're so stuck on numbers and where's the relationship and really kind of co-creating a different language about how to then go back and address this question around impact measurement and how it's keeping us very much stuck in a, you know, the current measurable paradigm. In fact, we need to, you know, shift the paradigm. And so, and generally those conversations have a lot of like laughter and sort of some silliness. It's often women.
I think it's a vulnerability thing. I think it's because we don't know the answers to things and we sort of feel a bit like we're making it up as we go, but it feels so right. Yeah. That you, it's sort of a nervous laughter, but an excited laughter. You sort of feel like there's a anticipation. You're filled with anticipation.
Yeah, and hope lives there too. You know, not a hope as in I need to see change out in the world and all of a sudden there's been an announcement about a new government or a new solar farm. Like that's nice, but that doesn't give me lasting inner hope. It makes me go, oh, I'm glad change is happening, but there's so much more to do. Tick, yeah, where is those conversations around the way we can live in the world, which is defined by a completely different paradigm, and that we can actually start to have a conversation about with a group of intelligent people and have a bit of a laugh and just kind of relate, is where I get joy and hope.
So powerful, but so simple actually in many ways. Mm. A willingness to lean into the things we don't know the answer to and find others that we can build solidarity in that with. Yep. And I, as you say, build a new language and build a new set of solutions.
Yeah, and I think that language bit, like I struggled having conversations like this a few years ago because I did not have any of the words to talk about it, and it was just about having a bit of a braveness to just try and then fumble for it and then find someone, and mostly you get people going, what? Like, and then, okay, wrong person, I won't talk to you about it. I'll try somebody else. And then all of a sudden someone's like, oh, yeah. And then you get on this great conversation and both of you, you leave those conversations feeling like you've just given energy to each other. Like there's this kind of shared of energy as opposed to when you've been zapped.
You don't feel sucked, you feel high.
You feel high. And so it's like, oh, yeah, that's kind of the piece I was saying as well around how, you know, when you on that path, those incremental kind of conversations when you keep kind of doing ones like that. Yeah, that I'm saying what I said before, but that's where hope lives and that's where joy lives.
I don't know how many philanthropists are listening in our audience because we have a very widely varied audience, but I suspect not that many. But if there were people out there who were listening to your story and thinking, I get it, that she saw she was in a position of privilege and she wanted to do something with it. What would you say to them? Where do they begin?
I actually think the place to begin is, like, it's inner work. It's exploring what is the uniqueness that you sit with in your context, you know, your beautiful skills, which you will have, where you can play a leadership position, and not necessarily a leader where you need to be confident standing up on a stage and talking to people, but, you know, being that brave person just on something where you feel you can, that you've got a slight, you can have a voice on. But that it does take, I think, inner work to understand those layers of what's blocking us, because I always find that when I find something sort of scary, it attracts me, because I'm like, there's something there that's blocking me. What is it? Why am I getting a bit triggered by this? And therefore, that's kind of an exciting journey to go on, to kind of unravel what it is, to then find out, like, break through it, and all of a sudden it's not a problem anymore. And, in fact, you've got this superpower that you didn't know that existed. And so I think to be really effective in philanthropy, you know, one answer could be, okay, so, you know, you should join the AEGN and you should go and get into networks and you should speak to people and, like, have a, like, all of that, yes. But I think fundamentally, to underpin all of that, I just think we need to go on these journeys ourselves. There was this, actually, a beautiful an organization which has just been founded called the Inner Development Goals. Actually, they might not even be just be founded. They're in Europe, so they could have been around for a while. I've only just discovered them. But the premise behind what they've said is that, you know, we've had the Sustainable Development Goals now for, like, I think 20 years, and we've achieved none of it. And, well, we're probably achieved, you know, in some areas we've done something, but ultimately there's still these big goals are sitting in the future when we were supposed to have nailed them by 2000. The piece that they said was, what's lacking is a human capacity to actually meet these challenges, because so many of the solutions to those goals we have, and we definitely know this within climate, we've got the solutions, but the human capacity to actually lead into the challenge and change is what is limiting us. And even though we might be the ones in philanthropy or investment or whatever who are working on the problem, we're part of the system too. Like, we are in it, and therefore we are just as important in terms of leaning into what needs to change. Like, just giving into it or investing and then sitting back and having a holiday to Europe over the summer, and I'm saying that in the nicest possible way because I did go to Europe. So I'm part of it, right? I'm part of the problem. Isn't necessarily enough. Like, I think it is about really discovering how we have that sort of really unique piece that we can play. And I've found that's where I've ended up going on these journeys, where I, you know, doing things I never thought I would do and speaking to people I never thought I would do, and finding that to be the most sort of rewarding of all of them.
While you've been on these journeys and meeting all these incredible people, have you had to unlearn anything that you consciously remember thinking, that's not how I do things, but I think I would like to do it that way. I need to unlearn my habitual approach.
100%, 100%. And I, if it's almost like if it's too easy and feeling like it's almost in the current paradigm and it's just operating that way, if that makes sense. So it's, in fact, I think they're the most, you know, rewarding and learning experiences when we get up against that bit, like, oh, hold on a minute, where am I being triggered? Why am I feeling that way? I'm feeling icky and uncomfortable. I actually need to do some work on myself before I can even really make a difference in this area. So, constantly, and there's still plenty more to do. I think in, you know, the world of, you know, our First Nations Australians and how we evolve into that work, like, I can't get past the fact that I am a privileged white person who has, you know, come to these lands that were not ours, and I can do, you know, some nice work and we can give to some projects, but that's not really going to solve the problem, right? So to even be present and understand that kind of the how my privilege and leaning into what that actually meant, and being really uncomfortable with that and trying to just undo some of the stuff that I know that was just put in there from my education, you know, probably well intended, but not serving where we're going in the future. Plenty of those.
If you could have more of one thing in your everyday, what would it be?
Time.
No doubt.
I think I would probably just carve out more time to be in the meditate, be in a mindfulness state. I think that's the bit that I and that might be, you know, other things around it, whether I go and, you know, do something nice for myself, whether it's a massage or, you know, acupuncture or something. Just I think the piece that gets left behind often is the self-sustainability. So if I had, if I would do one thing more, if I could have more in that day, I think, and I'm my own worst enemy in that sense. I'm not, there's no blame to the world. I've got to create that. I know that. That's just a daily one that I find, yeah, come up against it.
And so we've talked about a lot of things. Do you feel like there's anything else that is burning inside you that you'd like to share with our listeners before we sign off?
We've covered a lot of ground. What's a burning thing that I'd like to? Just how wonderful the sustainable table tea is. Well, I mean, I say that sort of lightheartedly, but it kind of comes into so many of my answers when I've talked about where I find joy, where I find hope to be in those conversations. They're often around people who are within that world. And when you have those conversations, I do have moments of like, oh, you can, yeah, you see what the future could look like if we all started to operate a little bit more like this, and how important that is in terms of me being able to move into different areas of life and different kind of compartments of, you know, business to investment to philanthropy and that sort of stakeholder piece, is that like you're holding this, when I say warmth, but I think it's something more than that. It's just like I've got this crew of people that they're my people, you know, like you're on the journey together. So there's a strength and a bravery that comes with it. And that's, I think, really powerful in terms of, you know, pushing into the areas that aren't ready to hear, because you've got to say things and it make people uncomfortable, and you've got to be brave to do that. And so you sort of, I feel like having that kind of powerhouse of people and networks and that you can share stuff with is like the secret sauce in that.
It's a courageous solidarity. And you feel like you're in a bit of an untouchable glass dome.
Yep. You're in that dome too, Jade.
Well, I have to say, if you don't have an untouchable glass dome, that's a really good place to go and to be once you've done that inner work. Hey, thank you. You are an incredibly busy woman, so to get an hour and a half of your time is a gift and a luxury for not only me to chat with you and hear some of the filled-in pieces of the story that I didn't know, but also to share that with all of our Future Steading listeners. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I always have an hour for you, so I hope other people find it useful.
Seems regardless of where and how you live, being human is the thing that fills our cup, and being courageous and vulnerable in that humanity is something that all of us need in spades. Next week, we'll go from an investor to an artist. I'm going to introduce you to Megan Grant, who was the artist behind all of the beautiful creations that you see in my book, Future Steading. Until then, have a beautiful week.